I got nothing to do, man. I'm watching old episodes of The Wire right now.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Dimeback Podcast. I'm Tyler Wilkinson. Are we recording?
Yeah. No, that was good. Okay. I like it.
All right. I'm joined by our staff writers, Russ Steinberg.
Hi, I'm Russ.
Megan Bard.
Hi, I'm Russ.
And Alex Cohen.
Hi.
Hi, Alex.
Hi, Alex. I'm Russ.
I like this. And Meacham's not here, so I get to I get to take the awful accent version of this.
My name is
that
Jeff.
My accent?
Yeah, my name's Russ. Here's how I talk all the time. It's my normal voice.
I would prefer that to my normal voice.
So this is exciting. Later in the podcast, we're going to hear from NBC Sports Rob Dowster. We're going to talk about Kevin Ollie's.
Dowster.
Damn it. I got it right in the interview. We already did it. How did I do that, man? So anyways, we talked to Rob about Kevin Ollie's future, how easy or difficult it is to work with UConn's athletic department. Some good stuff I think you'll enjoy. But before we get into that, I want to talk a little bit about, I guess, sort of just the global state of the program, right? I mean, we wrote that piece this week about how their attendance is down, the quality of play is down, the scoring is down, the ticket prices are still high. And it feels like we're reaching sort of a boiling point between UConn and its core fan base. I mean, does that seem accurate?
Well, its core fan base is on this podcast.
This is us. Yes, the four of us.
It's literally all that's left.
Yes.
No, but like, I mean, I think we're also talking about it seems like everybody has the story that they've had season tickets since the field house. You know, there's some of those people are coming out and saying how they've been treated by the program. I mean,
yeah, it's been an interesting mix. Yeah. I'll say in the reaction to the piece. So like we had probably close to a dozen probably old time season ticket holders who have basically lamented how their relationship with UConn has deteriorated in the last, call it, decade or so. And then there was also a few younger season ticket holders who were remarking about how they think it's easier now to get tickets and you can choose your own seat online. And they think the athletic department or, you know, donor relations are being responsive to them. So it does sort of feel like there's a generational aspect to this too.
Maybe these old people just can't figure out how to work the computer.
Honestly, if you've bought tickets for 30 years and all you had to do was like call your guy at the 486 number or whatever it is, like,
yeah,
they probably are not going onto the website and picking their own seats.
But even the other thing that we talk about is like the cost of these tickets right now is pricing out too many people. Like the difference between selling a $15 ticket or a $20 ticket and a $30 ticket is like pretty significant, especially when you're talking about, you know, parking and you're going to get food and maybe some beer and like, not at Gamble, but at the XL Center, you know, if you're going out, if you're going to make a day of it, I mean, they should sell. It's ludicrous that they don't sell beer at Gamble. Like, hello, you're trying to make money. Sell freaking beers. Anyway, it just seems like I might have gone to Coppin State for $15. I wasn't going to go for $30. And I've been wondering about this with the secondary market, because I know Ticket Galaxy and StubHub, but like Ticket Galaxy actually has like a relationship with UConn Athletics and end up with, like, they sell a lot of these tickets. And I sometimes wonder how much of this is, you go onto the website at UConn Athletics, you look at some tickets, and then it's like, oh, it doesn't really look like there's that many tickets. But it turns out there's like an absolute shitload of them on Ticket Galaxy. Maybe for more, maybe for less, hard to say. But like it's hard to figure out like where the tickets are. And I'm kind of wondering if UConn's screwing themselves by letting the secondary market into the process so early on before offering them to the fans. I don't know. It just seems like it's a weird way to do it. And it's not, it's requiring too much effort on the part of fans to like get tickets for not $1 million.
Yeah, I don't really understand this either, because I looked at UConnTickets.com before the Coppin State game, just because this was something that we were talking about. And there were no seats available in that lower bowl, none. And all of the like sideline seats in the 200s were either singles only or like scattered like double seats. And then the announced attendance was, what, 3,000?
Basically.
Yeah.
So there were 7,000 empty seats or 7,000 unsold tickets.
Right.
So why couldn't I have bought one?
Not to mention.
A couple days before.
You could have bought a 100 level ticket the day before.
For like $5 on StubHub.
Yeah. Like $9. Literally $9.
Yeah. There is zero reason to buy a single game ticket through UConn Athletics.
It does also sort of feel like there's sort of like two sets of core UConn constituents at the moment. There's like the, I'll call them for lack of a better term, the sort of the old money guys, the guys mm-hmm. that are probably writing $1,000 checks at least to the athletic department year after year and are getting tickets as part of that and may or may not even, you know, they're investing in sort of the general health of the program, but are not going to bother coming to the Coppin State game. So I imagine that's part of it. And then there's also, you know, the older demographic that is not necessarily money, that has had their season tickets for years and years, that has sort of been pushed up into the 200 section, you know, over the years, might not even know how to get their way back down to the 100 section. And I feel like they are being just generally disenfranchised.
Yeah. So, and I talked about this on Twitter, but I'll say it on here too. My dad started buying season tickets for men's basketball very shortly after he graduated. So like mid-70s. And he had season tickets until, I think, the 2009 season. And in that time, he donated every year. He bought season tickets every year for Gamble and the XL Center. We were in the 200s in both venues every single year. We started getting pushed further up in the XL Center, probably around 2004, 2005-ish, to the point where we were one of the last rows, despite having season tickets for my entire life. We started going to the Big East tournament every year, and in 2006, when the Big East expanded, UConn stopped filling our request for tickets because wow. They said that they were out of their allotment, so we had to get them through StubHub. And it got to the point, and there were other reasons too. I mean, 2009, the economy sucked, and there were definitely other factors, but he just stopped getting season tickets, and it hasn't been worth it to do it again because it's still $30 a game for a vastly inferior product, and we were treated like such crap beforehand. Despite giving them so much money, that why would we do that now? And if we just want to go to an individual game, we'll go on StubHub, pay a lot less, and go whenever we want.
The thing about this is I don't necessarily even think it's the wrong economic move necessarily. It's just acting in such bad faith with your constituents that are already, I feel like, dropping more and more each year.
And I think you put it perfectly in your piece when you said it feels like UConn thinks that they are owed the support of their fans, no matter what product they're putting out on the court. And clearly, a lot of fans feel differently.
Yeah,
it just feels like a very short-sighted move, if nothing else. Like, the economics of selling at an individual game a more expensive ticket versus a less expensive ticket, but you're not just bring people to that one game. Like, having a more filled arena is in and of itself a valued asset, and not acknowledging that you are depreciating the quality of your product by keeping your arena half full. You have to get butts in the seats, because if you don't get butts in the seats, it's not fun for the people who are there, and they're less likely to come back. Like, you need to convince people not just to buy that one ticket. You need to convince them to buy 5 tickets and then 10 tickets and then season tickets. So, like, if you're doing a shitty job of getting them first in the door to begin with, and two, to make the thing fun, like, it's just such an unreasonable expectation. And I think it's ignoring the reality and also not thinking about the bigger picture of things.
Yeah. And so I was talking to a friend of mine who lives in the Harford area, and I was contrasting UConn's current predicament with the Yard Goats. You know, there's a uniqueness draw. People want to come see the stadium for the first time. But the way that they sell the experience of attending the game has almost nothing to do with the product on the field. it's almost as if UConn expects the historic product to do all of the selling for them. But you think about it, if you are a casual basketball fan and you say in whatever, September, say, oh, we should get UConn tickets this year. I'll take the family of four and we'll go. And you say, oh, this Saturday, the 9th looks nice. We'll buy tickets to Coppin State. And you have to shell out $120 through UConn site. And you go to the game and you're one of like 3,000 people watching a shitty UConn team struggle to a victory against Coppin State. There is no chance you're coming back this year. But like maybe if you paid $10 a ticket, you would.
I went to a Wolfpack game because the tickets were pretty cheap. And I was like, cool, I can have dollar hot dogs and $2 beer. Like, you'll go to that because that activity, even absent the sport, is fun. And I think UConn needs to recognize that the game itself isn't fun enough to sell the experience. They need to make the rest of what's there fun.
It doesn't even have to be permanent. I mean, UConn just needs to figure out a way to retain its fan base through its bad years. I mean, if the team sucks forever, then it's not going to matter. But assuming, you know, because we're all cockeyed optimists in this here podcast, that this is not the forever state of UConn basketball. Thanks, Russ. You know, they need a way to weather the storm, and it's not pretending like nothing has changed. That's not good enough.
Right.
I mean, I think you're always going to get the nostalgia crowd. You know, you put a Big East opponent in the Civic Center on a Saturday, the old school fans are going to buy those tickets. I think that's always going to be a thing you get. But the reality is, like, our schedule's not made up until we're all dead. But I mean, the point is, like, that's not who we're bringing. You know, that's not our entire regular season conference schedule anymore. That's what it used to be. And there just needs to be an acknowledgement that the picture isn't as rosy as it used to be. And you can't expect the fans to act as if everything's still awesome.
So I agree with your point that UConn should go back to the Big East.
That is exactly my
point.
That's
what I heard. I mean, was that
if they do, they will sell a lot more tickets.
Very true.
It's very true.
Did someone read the J. Timothy's menu?
I think without Meech this week, we're going to have to skip. We'll just say the podcast is proudly brought to you by J. Timothy's Tavern in Plainville, Connecticut. They have amazing
wings.
Proudly.
They're not proud.
We're proud. They're not proud of us.
We're proud of it.
We're proud of
we're
them.
Gonna,
they're not proud of us.
We're not going to read the menu, but we're just going to guess that they have some fucking soup or something.
I mean, just order the wings.
Can we talk about the soap wings?
Oh.
Their slogan is...
I forgot all about the soap wings.
Hold on, guys.
Yeah, no, this will be the ad, because Megan has opinions about soap.
No, so did you guys see this tweet that J. Timothy's tweeted out? These little, like... They look like a little cardboard dish with wings and celery and blue cheese, but apparently it is soap. And at first I was like, this is a joke, right? This is clearly a well-executed joke, but it appears to be real.
You want to hear my theory about this?
Is it fake? Do you think it's fake?
No, I don't think it's fake.
I think it's real. It's got to be real. I want it to be real.
I think it's real, and I think J. Timothy's hired Chris Gross to...
This comes full circle. He's already working in Connecticut.
I think it's genius. I'm so here for them. They're so delightful, and I frankly, it just explains everything about why they like our whole nonsense.
I look at the picture, and I can't separate in my head that the soap smells like wings.
Right. It should.
It probably smells like soap, which is what you would want from soap, I would think.
Right.
I believe
right.
they said it's like vanilla and cinnamon scented soap. So like you would eat the wings and get covered in wings, and then you would take the wing soap and wash your hands with it, and now you smell
probably
like
shouldn't
vanilla.
Mix
You'd have to keep them in designated zones so you don't actually wash your hands with the real wings or eat the soap.
I feel like that one's more problematic.
Well, maybe.
All I know is I want it. I want it in my life.
I'm not discounting the possibility that the soap is delicious.
I will say that if J. Timothy's decided to sell those, I would buy them.
I believe isn't that the shtick? They are actually selling them.
That's... Are they available on the internet?
They also sponsor this podcast. I feel like, you know, J. Timms, okay.
Hook a girl up with your crazy soap.
Slide into the
Would
emails?
It be a bad idea for me to say my address on here so they can mail me some?
Yeah, probably.
Listen, I will use it. I will review the wing soap on this podcast.
So joining us today, a special edition of the A Dime Bag podcast, we have from NBC Sports, Rob Doster. Did I pronounce it right?
Yeah, you got it, man. It's I'm impressed. You know, not everybody gets that first shot.
It took a few practice tries before we hit record, to be honest. So the reason we really want to talk to you today is because you wrote a piece this week called UConn and Kevin Ollie No Longer Have Excuses for Their Struggles, which was pretty pretty brutal in your assessment of Kevin Ollie. You want to maybe just run through like a quick summary of your thoughts?
Well, I feel like, so everyone knows that outside of the year that he won the title, and it feels weird saying this, but outside of the year where he won the title, like, that UConn has not really lived up to the expectations that I think fans have and that I probably think exist within that program. And he's been to what? I think he's been to two NCAA tournaments. Mm-hmm. He's missed two of the last 3 years. And the 3 years that he's missed, like, you can, there's a reason for it. There's like an excuse for it, right? Like, the first year, they weren't even eligible to go.
Right.
The third year after they won the title, they lost Shabazz. They lost DeAndre Daniels. I think they lost two other seniors, and they had a bunch of young kids and new pieces on that team. And it's not always easy to integrate new people. Like, I get it, all right? Sometimes teams aren't that good. And then even last year, they lost their two best players to injury, so you can kind of explain away why they weren't as good as we wanted them to be. This year, there really is not an excuse. And I know you can say that Al Tariq isn't there, and I know that you can say Juwan Durham and Steve Enoch transferred out, but isn't it part of being a coach of a program to keep your kids within the program, like to keep them from transferring out, especially when we're talking about a top 50 kid in Juwan Durham and a top 75 recruit from Connecticut in Steve Enoch? So the fact that he lost those players, the fact that UConn fans are sitting here grasping to the idea that it's Al Tariq Gilbert being out is the reason that they're struggling, I just think it's a sign of where the program is. We're talking about a team that 4 years ago won their second national title in 4 years, and now we're saying the reason that they are losing by 35 to Arkansas, the reason that they're going to overtime with a 1-9 Columbia team and going to overtime with Monmouth at home is because this one kid that was a McDonald's All-American 2 years ago is injured. Like, that's just not – that's not valid to me. And at some point, you kind of have to say, you know, you can't – there's nothing you can blame for this. You're just not doing the job.
Now, in fairness to Kevin Ollie, you know, beating Monmouth at home in overtime is still better than losing at home to Wagner. So we're trending in the right direction.
Yeah, it's going the right direction, but it's not – I don't know. It's frustrating, man. And I don't know if everybody listening to this is aware of it, but I grew up in Connecticut. I grew up a UConn fan. I still have UConn stuff on my walls. Like, I have my old – Ray Allen, like, UConn jersey from, like, when he was there in, like, 1995 that I'm waiting to get framed. I'm going to put it up on the – hang it up on the wall of my – the basement of the new house we just bought. And it's frustrating to see the program at this point and where they are now, because it was – I mean, I don't have to explain it to you guys, but it's just such a critical moment when you go into this new league and you're trying to find your way in a conference that's not the old Big East, to go to where they are now. Because once you kind of lose that grip on having national relevance, there's no reason for UConn basketball to, like, be nationally relevant, right? Like, they're not North Carolina, they're not Duke. So at some point, you just kind of have to, yeah, you can't let it slip away, because it's going to be really hard to get back, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned Ollie and some of the problems that have come up. You also mentioned the AAC. How do you sort of differentiate, or at least target, where the struggles are arising? You talked to a scout you mentioned in your or a coach, I guess, in your piece, and who had scouted you, kind of said it was the simplest and easiest scout he'd done all season, which is pretty damning. So where do you
He actually said it was the simplest, the easiest scout that he's seen since he's been a coach.
So that's not great.
That's not good.
I think that there was a little bit of exaggeration involved in that. And the thing is, like, that's kind of how it's always been. Like, even, like, Jim Calhoun never really ran all that exciting of an offense and really all that intricate of set plays or anything, right? Like, what they kind of did was built on this idea where you're not going to score on us. We're going to press you. We're going to have all these shot blockers at the rim. We're going to make it very difficult for you to get baskets. And then we're going to have enough talent on the floor where it doesn't really matter if we just run kind of simple actions and simple sets. And I think that Kevin Ollie is doing something kind of similar. The problem is they can't defend. Like, honestly, and this is the dead honest truth, I could not name a single big guy on that roster coming into the season. The first time I watched the game, I was like, so who are these kids? I don't know who any of these guys are.
Right.
And like, I cover this sport for a living and I'm a UConn fan. So that kind of tells you what you need to know about the front court they have. And then offensively, I mean, other than Jalen Adams, is there anybody out there that really is a guy that can go get his own shot that you're worried about maybe getting you 20 points on a given night? So he's not doing anything all that dissimilar from what Jim Calhoun did, but it's just they don't have the guys, right? I'm curious. What's your guys' take on that? I'm curious because the way I see it is he just doesn't have the players, and I don't know if it's recruiting. I don't know if it's development within the program. I don't know if it's actually keeping kids that are good enough from leaving the program. But there's something that's not working there.
Well, I'll tell you this: when Tyler dropped your piece into our Slack, I think I was the first one who read it, and I immediately reported back that this is everything we've all been saying to each other, like internally. So I don't think you're that far off, really, on any of this. I think it's funny that you mentioned Durham and Enoch, because I actually think the biggest loss is Jackson. Of the three guys that left, the one that I would most like to have on this team is Vance Jackson. I would like the 3-point shooter, at least halfway decent guy to play. Like, he'd be starting at the four if we had him right now. There's obviously something going wrong within the program, but you aren't seeing guys developing the way they need to, because it's not like Calhoun recruited tons of studs. You know, it's not like he was ever getting the quality of kids that Duke and Kentucky were getting, but he was much better at developing them and, you know, finding guys who were going to work within his system and then, you know, teaching them. But I mean, he was a Hall of Fame coach. Are we ever going to get maybe one of the best coaches of all time? Probably not. But Ollie doesn't really seem to have an ability to develop these players in a way that they find meaningful, and that's certainly problematic.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a good point on Vince Jackson. He actually just slipped my mind because, that would be the perfect guy at the four for him, right? Like, if you look at the best teams they've had, that's kind of the role that their foreman has been, just kind of spaced. Like, DeAndre Daniels was that guy, right? So
running, like, pick and pops to Vance Jackson, who can, like, hit from three, it would have been beautiful.
And when you have Jalen Adams out there, if you have another shooter on the floor, then all of a sudden it's that much more spread and there's more space in the paint. You're getting me more fired up here, Megan.
I'm sorry.
I think administratively there's some frustration and some lack of clarity. And that's another big theme with the UConn men's basketball program, is there's so little transparency into how things work. And that translates over to, like, you know, we don't know anything about this team outside of what we see on the court. Like, there's no view into the players, the program, how the coach operates, nothing. It's a very closed door operation. Yeah. So I think part of our frustration and as UConn fans is just that we just don't know what's going on.
From my perspective, since I've been doing this nationally, they're one of the least easy teams to deal with in terms of trying to get, like, maybe Kevin Ollie on the phone or a player on the phone or something like that.
Let's just say this has been discussed off podcast in the recent past.
And Kevin Ollie's, like, he's a very nice guy, and, you know, he's always friendly to me when I see him, but it's just the difference between, like, him being nice to a reporter, because that's just kind of what you do in those settings. Like, hey, man, good to see you. How you doing? How's everyone? How's the summer been? You know, how's the kids? All that kind of stuff. But the difference between, like, that stuff at, like, a media day versus being able to get him on the phone because I want to do, like, a feature story on, like, a Jalen Adams or something like that is a little bit more difficult. And just to put it into context, with Michigan State, I did something on Miles Bridges before the season, right? And I just shot an email over to Matt Larson, their SID. He got back to me in 5 minutes. The next day, I had Miles Bridges via Skype to record a podcast with him while I did the interview. And then, like, an hour later, I had Izzo on the phone. And I had it all done within, like, probably 24 hours of sending him that initial email. And it's just, it's never been quite that easy when dealing with UConn. And to be honest, like, I haven't actually done it as much recently because there hasn't been as much of a cause to want to do something, a big story on any of their guys. So
because as Jeff Goodman likes to put it, they're no longer nationally relevant.
Where's the lie, though? Like that's true.
Yeah, like here's the thing: like Jeff likes to rag on UConn mostly because he likes to rile up the UConn fans, and so it's kind of funny. Like when he kind of kicks that beehive. But like he's not totally wrong, is he?
He's 100% right. Absolutely right about everything, to be honest. Yeah,
yeah. And I hate it, man. I just whenever he does that, I just leave it alone. I just ignore. Well,
the thing about that, and like I used to hate it, and now I'm kind of entertained by it because I've come to realize that UConn is the closest traditionally relevant school to where he lives. So I'm not dumb enough to think that he just wants to sit there and watch UConn fail, because it's a lot more fun if the teams around you are good. Like, even if you're not a fan of them, it is fun to cover teams that win. So obviously, Goodman, if UConn was winning national championships or was a top 10 team every year, he would have a lot more to talk about. He would have a lot more to do. So I don't buy that he hates UConn. I think it's 100% that he loves to rile up UConn fans, and yeah, I don't blame him because it's so much fun.
I know the teams and the coaches that he hates. I'm not gonna say it publicly because I'm not gonna put him on blast like that. But UConn is not one of those teams. He loves Jalen Adams. He loved Shabazz Napier. Like those were his guys.
Yeah,
those are Boston guys.
Right.
Those are guys that he knew since they were freshmen and sophomores in high school. So, like, it's not the idea that he hates UConn. It's not that. I promise you. He just enjoys trolling you guys. And look, I'm not going to lie. Like, he gets me, too. That's kind of why sometimes I have like, all the guys at Break News set up as notifications on my phone for tweets.
Yeah.
And whenever I see his tweet about UConn come up, I just, toss the phone over. I can't deal with this, because about four more are coming immediately. He's going to quote tweet two fans and say something else. And, look, I don't hate UConn. They're the closest team to me. I want them to be good. They're just not. Like, that's what that's his tweets, right? Mm-hmm. That's basically what it is. He says something, quote tweets a fan, quote tweets another fan, and then says, I want UConn to be good. I can't deal with that
anymore. I love it.
So, Rob, I want to backtrack real quick on, going off your story about Michigan State there. What is sort of what's the standard for you? How easy is it normally for you to get that sort of access from a, call it like a Power Five level school?
Well, Michigan State is kind of unique. So maybe they weren't the best example just because they are there's a reason that every media member loves Tom Izzo, because he's just so accessible. He'll answer the phone when you call him. If you want to do like an interview or a podcast, he'll make time. He'll make himself available for it. And most schools aren't quite like that. Some of them are a little bit more difficult. UConn's probably on the more difficult end. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it depends on the coach. It depends on the relationship you have with the coach. There's a lot of there are some head coaches I know where I don't even have to go through the SID. I'll just shoot him a text and be like, hey man, you got 15 minutes tomorrow. I have to talk to you about something.
Right.
And that'll work. There are other ones where they want you to go through the SID because they just have no idea what their schedule is.
Right.
And that's honestly true. They don't know what they're going to be doing the next day. So if you email the SID, he can bring up the schedule and say, okay, I can fit you in at this time. You got 15 minutes. But I mean, for the most part, when I was still doing balling as a habit, it was a little bit more difficult. But once you can say NBC
right
there, that kind of gets you in the door with just about anyone that you need. Unless it's Kevin Ollie.
So for sort of lower level schools, I don't know, say some MEAC school thinks they have a good hook for one of their players. Will they pitch you? Do you get pitch emails?
Yeah, every once in a while.
So what kind of pitches do you get normally, when they do come? Are they from the SID usually?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of times it normally happens closer to the end of the year, when guys are having big years, they'll just they'll blast out those emails where it's like, hey, this guy's averaging this many points and this many rebounds, and he's doing this and this. And once you get on I think the USBWA mailing list.
Russ is a member.
Yeah. Do you ever get those random things sent to you? I got
end of the season. Yeah.
And I got, like, I still have, I don't know if it's here, I still have, like, a Two Holloway bobblehead. Remember Two Holloway from Xavier?
Yeah. I forget Two Holloway.
I have a Doug McDermott bobblehead, like, sitting around somewhere.
Wow. I don't get any of those.
I have a beer opener. That literally, it's a beer opener with Denzel Valentine's Michigan State jersey on it, which is actually awesome. That's
really cool.
I had that somewhere. I don't know where it is. That might have got lost in the move. If that got lost in the move, I'm going to be really mad because that thing was awesome.
So also while we have you, Raul, let's talk about the podcast you did, your Overreactions podcast, which the overreaction, admittedly self-titled, was that Kevin Ollie needs to be, or maybe should be, fired at the end of the year. Is that, tell us where you land on the reasonable reactions part of that equation.
It depends on how the season plays out, I think. You know, if he can, there's still time to turn this thing around. Mm-hmm. And if he does, then, you know, I think that you just kind of ride it out, because I'm not sure that you want to go through that whole hiring process again. But if he doesn't, like, let's say that they finish, what, like 6-10 in the AAC, and they miss out on the NCAA tournament, and they have another year where they're kind of in that, like, 500 range on the season.
Mm-hmm.
At what point do you just kind of look at the way that the program is trending, in the most important point of the program's history, and not say, okay, maybe this isn't working, right?
What if they go, you know, 18-15 and miss the tournament? You know, where do you think that line is? Or do you think it's, you know, a moving target?
I think it's a moving target. I think you just have to look and, like, are they better than what they've been? You know, like, they just haven't been good so far. So are they better than what they've been? And, like, they're losing, they take a couple close losses to Wichita State, or, you know, they lose at the buzzer a couple of different times. But if you think about it, the reason that they made the NCAA tournament, was it 2016 that they made it because Jalen Adams hit an 80-footer? Mm-hmm. Like, if he doesn't make that shot, are they in the tournament?
There's probably disagreement within this.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I say no, others say yes.
Whatever it is.
I mean, say probably not, but it was borderline, like, regardless.
Right.
So if that's what you're looking at and that's what you're working with, at some point you just have to say, like, this is not working. And I think that if he has a bad year, then I think you have to say that. You know, I don't like, to be honest, like, I hate when we have to talk about, like, doing the hot seat lists and saying that this guy needs to be fired, because the idea of saying that about people, some of them, like, are more friendly with than others, but when you have to say that about someone, and then if you think about that as a person, right, you know, they have, one, they lose a job, which is obviously not the most, it's a little bit embarrassing when that happens. Two, like, you're saying that he's not good at what he does, and these are prideful people, and I'm sure that stings. But more importantly, like, think about it from the perspective of him having a family.
Right.
You know, he's going to have to uproot his family. Does Kevin Ollie have kids that are young enough to still be in school?
I think they're college age now.
Yeah, so maybe it doesn't affect him as much. But, like, if say his kids were, like, 12 years old, he would have to, like, uproot his kids and uproot his family, and they would have to move and relocate to somewhere else, and that's never fun to do, so... Think about it from that perspective. Like, I hate this idea of, like, having to say, like, okay, this school needs to fire this guy.
Right.
Having said that, I think you need to look at this as a situation where maybe this is not working out. And at some point you have to kind of say, like, okay, maybe this idea of letting Jim Calhoun pick a successor didn't go as well as we had planned.
So I'll rep No Escalators, since they couldn't make it to this podcast. But one half of No Escalators persistently reminds us that the options out there that UConn is likely to attract, are they really more attractive than current Kevin Ollie?
I think so.
Well, I guess what I'd like from your perspective is who are realistic targets that UConn could even think about being in on?
Keep in mind, we all have the same two names in mind. So
is one of them at a school at Rhode Island, the other one at a school in New Jersey?
You mean,
yes, that you got
ding,
them
ding,
all.
Ding, 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 yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So those are the names that I keep hearing when I ask people, but it's like it's kind of too early to really get too involved in kind of those. Like, I don't even know if Danny Hurley would consider that job if it came open. But, I mean, I think that you would actually have a shot at getting them. And I think if you can get Danny Hurley like that, I think that that's something that would actually work. If you can actually go out and get Steve Peichel, like, I think he's a really good coach. Mm-hmm. I think in 3 years, like, he'll have Rutgers doing something good enough where a bigger school is going to come along and pick him up.
Right, but why would he leave a Big Ten school? Is UConn a bigger school than Rutgers anymore?
No, but he's a UConn guy. Like, he grew up in Connecticut. He went to UConn. He was an assistant for Jim Calhoun. I think that all carries some sort of weight.
Okay. Yeah, I think he'd still take the job.
If he's looking at future prospects, though, and what the resources of the program are going to be.
Also, Rutgers facilities are fiery hot trash, and UConn
that's changing, though. I think they are.
But currently they're bad, and UConn has completed beautiful, brand new practice facilities. And
UConn has showed that despite them being in the AAC, that they are committed to actually spending on their program and actually investing in it. Whether that equates to on-court success or not, we're not sure yet. But UConn, even if they don't have the Power 5 resources, they've shown that they're dedicated to using the resources that they do have in improving their basketball
program. And there's a brand that comes with UConn that's much bigger than Rutgers. Like, I understand why you wouldn't want to go from a good Big Ten program to UConn, but we're talking about Rutgers here. Right. Like, you have to be a fantastic basketball coach to get out of the cellar in the Big Ten. Like, that's why it's not a good job. Like, look at what Pat Chambers is doing at Penn State. I think Pat Chambers is an actual good coach. Right. And, like, it's taken him 7 years to get, like, a pipeline built from Philly and start getting some talent in. And all of a sudden, like, we're finally talking about them 7 years later as maybe being a team that could end up being on the bubble this year. And, like, do you want to do that if you're Steve Peichel, to build and build and build and build and build, and in 7 years maybe have the chance to get to the tournament or get fired? Or
he's already out-recruiting UConn. Like, he's brought in two guys who have chosen Rutgers over UConn.
Yeah, but I mean, Kevin Ollie's still, like, for all the hell that we're giving him about the guys that are currently on that roster, it's not like he hasn't gotten guys. Like, he got Jalen Adams. He had Mekhi Ashton-Lakeford until Mekhi realized that he would, like, Jalen Adams was still going to be on that roster. Al-Tariq Gilbert's a McDonald's All-American. Juwan Durham was a top 50 kid. Steve Enoch was top 75. The Sid Wilson kid that's sitting out is a top 75. So it's not like he's not getting players.
Daniel Hamilton.
I think that Daniel Hamilton. I think you can still get dudes to go to UConn. I don't think that's the issue. The issue is what happens when you actually get there. Keeping them there, making them better, and putting them in a situation where they can succeed.
Now,
and I think that that is where the problem is.
UConn, in addition to having players transfer out, has also had several guys commit and then decommit, like Mekhi Ashton-Lakeford. They have James Aquino. Is that how you say his name?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They have him next year. He was the MVP of Peach Jam, and I guess his stock has really been increasing since he committed. If UConn starts losing commits like him, does that sort of take precedence over even how UConn finishes this year when you're thinking about whether Kevin Ollie should keep his job?
Thad Matta lost his job in June, a couple weeks after they lost the commitment from Darius Bazley.
Right.
So, yes, it does, because you have to look at who is coming into the program. If you're saying there's not enough good players in this program right now, and then you lose the good players that are going to come into the program to replace them, that's the decision Ohio State had to make right there.
Right.
And they went out, and their, like, hiring process, like, didn't really go as planned either. Like, they whiffed on, was it Chris Mack, and they whiffed on someone else. And then Greg McDermott said no at Creighton before they ended up getting Chris Holtman, who was actually a fantastic hire. But still a
good hire.
Yeah, like, that was the best hire they could have made, I think, going there. But I think that that's something that you would have to think about with UConn as well, in terms of, like, is everybody going to say no? And maybe they will. But at some point you have to say, like, maybe having that embarrassment is worth the issues that would come if Kevin Ollie stays there. And I don't know, man. It's just such a – but you also got to figure, like, he won a national title. So, like, he's got to actually maybe be good at what he does. I don't know. It's frustrating, man. It's frustrating.
My theory has been, and is even stronger now, that he is an incredible motivator of players, which is why I think every time they're in a tournament, barring the second half of Michigan State and then the Arkansas game this year, but every time prior to that in the AAC tournament and the NCAA tournament, they really raise their level of play. The problem is he's a good coach of guys that don't require much coaching, I think. So when you get players that haven't played a lot together, or you get a bunch of fifth-year grad transfers in, or you get a bunch of freshmen who need to play a lot of minutes, I think he is not capable of getting that team, coaching that team, to where it needs to be at tournament time. My question has always been, is it possible to succeed without that? Can you fake that either through assistant coaches or just through better recruiting?
I don't know. I think I do agree with your point. Like, he's, you have good players, he does stuff, and the way that he runs his teams are ways that good players would thrive. Like, if you have Shabazz Napier and you just give Shabazz the ball and say, all right, Shabazz, go make something happen. Like, right. I'm serious when I say that they're like, that's being a good coach, because the best thing that you can do for your team is give the ball to your best player and let him go make the play. The problem is, I don't think Jalen Adams is quite at that level. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that the supporting cast that he has around him, like, if Jalen Adams isn't getting a shot, who do you trust to go out and create something? Because if Shabazz wasn't getting the shot, you still had Ryan Boatwright out there, right? And right. For all, like, Ryan Boatwright was flawed, but he's still a guy that can go out and get you 25 on, like, a given night if you got it going, right? DeAndre Daniels was a guy, I don't know if he ended up getting drafted, but he was good enough to at least, like, be considered by NBA teams.
Second round.
He was a second round pick? Yeah. So he got drafted. Is there anybody else on this roster other than Jalen Adams that you look at and say, okay, that guy is worth using a draft pick on?
I would be surprised right if Jalen Adams gets drafted.
Yeah, I would too.
Yeah, I guess.
It's wild.
I think he's pretty good. I feel like it's wrong to say he doesn't have that killer instinct either, because he has made some big plays down the stretch in some games. Granted, it's against, like, Monmouth and Columbia.
And it only turns on with 8 minutes left. Like, it's the thing that's been frustrating about Jalen is he's rarely up for the first half.
Do you think that that's maybe partly because he's trying to get other people involved, or it's just because he's cruising? I don't know. What's your take on why that is?
Well, it seems to be a common theme that runs through the team. There are several players who just don't seem awake for the opening part of the game. It's almost like they're just trying to let the game come to them. And I don't know if that's coaching or if it's I'm not sure, but this has been a frustration for a few years now, and it's not just Jalen Adams. It's been a common theme for UConn teams to start slow and then have to claw their way back into the game, and that's why we end up, you know, eking out, you know, single digit wins over by game teams. It's really frustrating.
And I think the best case of that, or the best example, was this Sunday when Coppin State, who is one of the worst teams in all of Division I, did not get to Gamble until, like, less than an hour before the game, like, because it was snowing or whatever. And they jumped out to an 11-3 lead, like, at the under 16 timeout.
Right.
What the fuck?
How? How did that happen? Like, you would think, like, forget about, like, what UConn's record was or how bad they looked against Monmouth. Like, those are Division I basketball players. UConn has those. And Coppin State really doesn't have too many, and, like, some guy off their bench scored 30 points against UConn, and UConn won by 13.
The thing I've found the most frustrating, I think, is how bad the defense has been. I expect them to play, like, pretty good defense, and the defense is so horrible. And it's like, it's not even just the, like, large adult sons that we have in the rotating cast in the post. It's like the perimeter defense is trash. They're giving up ludicrous number of threes in these games to these nothing schools. It's like, do we not remember how to guard people? Like, can we not get around screens anymore? Like, it's so frustrating to watch. But then sometimes they turn it on, like when they were running that weird ass four guard zone defense against Oregon, which worked better than it had any business to work. I don't know, it's just so perplexing to me, because it seems like they snooze on defense for, you know, half the game, and it's like, yeah, just spot on 30 points, no big deal.
The one thing I will say about that is I think that Al Tariq is the guy that kind of sets the tone for him on that end. Like, he actually is a very, very good defender. And when you kind of take away, like, it's almost like the head of the snake. And when you take that away, I think that it kind of affects him a little bit. But then again, like, he played against Arkansas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they gave up 102 points against Arkansas. So maybe that theory is bullshit.
Yeah, Like, that's the most frustrated I've ever been watching. I've ever been while watching UConn.
It feels very disengaged. Like, they're very disengaged from the game and each other. And
that's a good word. I like that word. I might steal that word for it. I'll give you credit.
Yeah,
preparation, at the very least, seems like a definitive problem.
Yeah, because we come out and we look totally unprepared for the specific way in which that opposition plays.
The Syracuse game, like the first few minutes of that game, when it looked like UConn had never seen a zone before, like they were shocked that Syracuse would be playing a 2-3 zone. Like, they couldn't possibly imagine that would happen.
Meanwhile, like, more than half the games we played this season, teams have come out and played zone against us because apparently
we're
the easiest scout in the history of
Florida's basketball. When you can't shoot, that's a good strategy.
Well, the thing about that is sometimes if you don't think that you have a guy that can stay in front of, like, Jalen, you'll go zone because it's easier to just keep him out of the lane then.
Right.
But still, you should have some kind of a zone offense to run.
Right.
And I think it was after the game against Syracuse, Kevin Ollie, I think, literally said in the press conference, "We looked like we never played against the zone before." And, you know, maybe you could do something about that, Kevin.
That's not the first time he said that, by the way. He said that multiple times over the last few years.
But it's almost like he's trying to pass off that was frustrating for me to hear, because it's almost like he's just trying to pass the blame off on the players there. Like, It's like in, you know, it's like in any job when you say, well, I told the guy to do it and you didn't follow through and actually train the person properly. Like, well, I told them what was going to happen when the zone, like, he just comes across in that moment like, I don't know what you want me to do. It was the players who looked like they never saw the zone before. Like, I was livid when I heard him say that.
Yeah. The funny part about that is that if he would actually let the media into practice ever, or see the team beyond, you know, the two guys that they bring into the media room, like, he could very easily show that he actually does coach this team and he actually does teach them how to prepare for a zone. But because he doesn't let the media anywhere near his program, we're left sitting here wondering what UConn does to prepare to face a Syracuse team that's thrown nothing at zone at you for the past 30 years.
And to be fair to him for a second, you know, I'm sure there's a ton of coaches out there who really don't want media near their program, and they just may be subject to athletic departments that say, well, sorry that you don't want the media near there. It's our university policy to have media involvement in our team. And he just maybe, like he doesn't want it, and the university just enables it.
I also don't think that, like, letting a reporter into practice is what proves that someone can actually coach, right? Like, I think that it comes through in the preparedness that your team has. So it's not like he's hiding anything by keeping people out of practice. And as we all know, it's not like he's protecting plays because they don't fucking run anymore. So, it's just a thing. I think it's a thing where some coaches have where, like, And to this point, I actually do kind of get it, where, like, practice is supposed to be where they can focus on getting better, and they can focus on developing, and they can focus on the team. And I honestly don't have any problem with a coach not letting anyone into a practice, because, like, I don't want to go to a college practice. I have absolutely zero desire to spend 2.5 hours listening to a coach, like, run through shell drill with somebody. Like, I don't have a need for that in my life. But being able to get into a room for 45 minutes after practice and sit down and have, like, a real conversation with one of the players, like, that is something that I don't think that we get. And I think that there are programs that let you know who their kids are better than what other programs do. And honestly, I think that's a good thing for their brand, right?
Right.
Like, look at Miles Bridges. Every single outlet has done a long feature on Miles Bridges. If you go through and look at NBC, SI, I don't know if CBS has done one, but I know ESPN has done
fucking
one. I know that the Athletic did one, and it's because Michigan State is so good at letting you find out who the kids are on their team, because they trust that their kids, the personality that they have, is going to shine through, and they have good kids on that roster. They don't have idiots on that roster, so they trust that if if they bring you in and they let those kids show themselves, they're going to show themselves well, right? So maybe that's part of it, but I don't...
I've been in the locker room now for 5 seasons, which feels insane to me, but they have amazing kids on these teams. Like, not only was Shabazz amazing, and I think reflected it in the stories that got covered because that team was really good.
Shabazz was the best, man.
Boatwright was an amazing quote and just like a really insightful, bright guy.
An amazing backstory and like cool family.
Really
like
impressive story. Sterling Gibbs on the 2016 mm-hmm. team. Incredibly bright, you know, gregarious guy who would, you know, was always good for like a great quote. Same thing with Rodney Purvis, who, you know, is sort of a touch point for UConn fans, but was just a really engaging, bright guy. And I would say the same thing about Jalen Adams. But the limits to what gets exposed is like 25 minutes after practice and 20 minutes after a game. And you have an entire horde of beat writers making their living off writing about this team who are giving essentially nothing about these guys who have stories to tell. I mean, these are good kids that am I wrong? Like, this would be such, it would be better for UConn globally to let these kids get recognition, and they're just seem unwilling to do so.
Yeah, it's a little frustrating, and there are a lot of good writers that cover them, right?
Totally.
Yeah. And it's always funny. Like, I love walking into UConn games because you see like the same like six guys, and they're all like sitting right next to each other.
They really are.
It's frustrating. I'm sure it's frustrating for them because they probably hear about all these great stories and maybe they don't get a chance to write them. And yeah, I do think it's good for some teams to be able to like get those players out there and kind of help them, maybe like build their brand is the wrong way to say it, but that's essentially what you're doing,
I
right?
I think that's the exact right mm-hmm. way to say it.
Yeah. So I can see how it would be frustrating that you can't get those stories out there and get those stories told.
But I mean, I also think it's manifested a little bit in like when in 2013, when they were banned from the tournament, Shabazz Napier was having an amazing year and was nowhere to be found in like national coverage. He was not in any draft boards the next year, you know, kind of similar with Ryan Boatwright. Like, these guys, I think, are also suffering a little bit just from a lack of recognition, which comes from being an underwhelming team in the 7th best conference.
Yeah, and it does help. I think the fact that the UConn has not been winning the games that we're used to seeing them win has hurt that. Like, when it was, you know, Ben Gordon and Emeka Okafor and Ray Allen and Khalid El-Amin and Rip Hamilton, and they were awesome, everybody wanted to talk about them, right? Because right. you're good. When you're not that good, no one wants to talk about you. And because a lot of those draft boards tend to be a little bit about hype. And you know what the best way to build hype about a player is? To get the media access to them and to get it out there publicly. So I can definitely see what you're saying there.
Rob, one other thing I wanted to ask you about before we let you go for the evening is explain to us what this 3-on-3 thing is that you are a member of the selection committee.
Oh, dude, it's actually awesome. So what they're doing at the end of the year at the Final Four, at the, you know, where they have like the slam dunk contest and mm-hmm. they have the 3-point shooting contest and all that.
For college seniors, right?
Yeah, what they're doing, and I'm pretty sure it's like by conference. So what you're going to do is any senior that is not playing in the Final Four is eligible to be picked on a team for their conference. So like it'll be the ACC, you take the 4 best seniors and you put them on a team for 3-on-3, one guy like subs through or whatever, right? And then you do that for each conference and they play a 3-on-3 tournament for $100,000.
Oh,
not nothing.
Not nothing, but they have to be seniors because they have to have their eligibility gone.
Right.
And they probably have to be guys that don't have a ton of NBA potential, because if there's 4 guys on the team, after taxes, we're talking about like what, 16 grand?
Right.
And I don't know if you'd want to risk.
Yeah. Not putting your ACL on the line for 16 grand?
Don't put your ACL on the line, especially like when you have to go start training and doing all the workouts and everything and like find an agent and all that stuff and go through the draft process. But even so, like a 3-on-3 tournament with a bunch of seniors that we've watched play for forever to win $100,000, I don't know. I love it. I think it's an awesome idea. I'm glad. I think it's Intersport that came up with it. They always throw an awesome party at the Final Four that I somehow sneak my way and luck my way into. And that's the best part about it is like Intersport always has an open bar party at the Final Four. And now that I'm like on their like selection committee, I shouldn't have to sneak in anymore, right? I should be able to just walk up and say, hey, I'm on your 3-on-3 selection committee. Let me in.
I would think that would be the benefit of being on the selection committee.
Yeah. Get on the list, man. Get on the list.
Selection committee.
Yeah, seriously, man. What I should do is print out that that thing that they put on Twitter. I should print that out, and when I walk up to the Final Four, I'll be like, "You got a name?" And just give that to them. And see what
laminate it and wear it on a lanyard around your neck.
Yeah, there you go.
I want you to just keep in mind that I have exhausted my college eligibility. So, you know, when you are picking teams, just, you know, keep that in mind.
We need a big guy, so you'll be perfect.
Russ will sit on anyone's shoulders and play center.
That's true. I could do that.
I'm sure you've already told the story, but can you take me through the story about how you got the picture when you were standing on the chair?
With Loma?
Back so to back!
So this actually started on Twitter like 3 years ago, I think. We were talking, I think it was when like Tyler first realized how short I am and he thought it would be funny for me to get a picture standing back to back with Rebecca Lobo. And that made its way onto Twitter and Lobo thought it was funny and it would always
delightful.
Yeah. She's great. Like it would always be where like I was covering a game and then she was there the next night. Like we kept missing each other to actually do this. And then there was a New York Liberty game that I was covering it for Summit Hoops and she was doing the broadcast. So I made sure, like I got there early and we made it happen. We did just that pic of us standing on the floor and then she suggested I get up on the chair. So we did that too. And what wasn't captured was that I actually fell like through the space between the back and the seat when I was trying to get off. And I wish that was photographed because that was probably like 100 times funnier than.
I'm sure it wasn't embarrassing at all.
No, like if I'm already willing to stand on a chair next to Rebecca Lobo, like how embarrassed am I going to be falling off of the chair?
And Rob, I don't know if you knew this, but you know, at any opportunity that presents itself, Rebecca will dunk on Russ on Twitter.
She has tormented him.
She will find me and like quote tweet me and just destroy me. Yeah. It's so much. It's so funny.
Why? She just likes you?
Or
the exact opposite. We're not sure.
It's funny to dunk on Russ.
Yeah, to be fair, it is fun to dunk on
Russ. It really is.
Well, it's a lot easier to dunk on me than like the average size person.
So, Rob, before we let you go, any shit talk for Matt Norlander you want to put on this podcast?
Is he coming on next?
No, but it's just something we like to do.
Do you guys really do that? Shit talk Matt Norlander?
No, but I have a very one-sided rivalry with him, with Russ's Silver Sword competition, which is where you pick all the winners of the early season tournaments. What it is. Yeah.
He got a little bit cocky with that, didn't he?
Yeah, and he finished in like 318th place.
You could ask him about his finishes in his NCAA tournament pools.
I will gladly ask him that.
Ooh.
His Nerdlander. Nerdlander is actually what we call him on our college basketball writer group text. He's Nerdlander. He is a big music nerd. He likes a lot of like weird music a lot of bands that I've never heard of. A lot of bands that probably were dead before he was alive. He's a good guy, though. He's got a cute kid.
In defense of him, he did, early in the days of A Dimeback, do a piece with us. He did a quick interview about UConn's preseason prospects, I think. I think he was wrong about all of it, but he did it. So,
shocker. Matt was wrong about something. Mm. Yeah, go figure.
We do our like preseason roundtable every year, and we're wrong about everything.
Whenever you see me bragging about something I got right during the season, it's because everything else I get wrong.
Yeah, same actually.
Yeah, right. If you're loud enough about the things you get right, the rest doesn't matter.
I don't think I've predicted the national champion right in I couldn't even tell you how long. And it's been probably like 4 years now that my wife has beaten me in an NCAA tournament pool. And yeah, I hear
about that. When was the last time that the preseason number one team won the national championship?
I don't know. When was the last time that the men's and women's team from a school won a national title in the same year?
Yeah, I don't think that's ever happened, actually.
Has it? I don't know. Certainly can't have happened twice.
That's my favorite bit on Twitter.
If only we had no escalators here right now.
Yeah.
I get, whenever he does that, like, I'll get like three texts from some buddies that'll just like send the tweet and be like, he did it again.
With the 280 characters, it's getting more difficult.
Yeah, but I just love how it just kind of like runs on. You'll start reading the tweet and it'll be like something normal, and then it'll be like, oh, yeah, he's doing it again. Well, that's almost as good as Rebecca Lobo dunking on Russ.
God bless Twitter.
Yeah.
All right, Rob, well, we'll let you go, but thanks so much for taking the time. And where should people go and read more of your insight?
They should, after they subscribe to this podcast, sure, they rate this podcast, and they review this podcast, and they say all the nice things about me, they should go and search the NBC Sports College Basketball podcast, subscribe to that, rate it, review it, and then say more nice things about me.
And where are you on Twitter?
At Rob Doster. D-A-U. Yes, you want to try to spell it, Tyler? Can you get that too?
D-A-U-S-T-E-R.
Bam, you got it.
Boom.
I spelled Rob.
I'm telling you, man. I'm prepared today.
Guys, I appreciate you finally having me on. I've been bugging Alex and Russ about this for like 3 years.
Yeah, I'm glad we were able to get you on, Rob.
Preparedness is not always our thing, so
I gotta say, I thought it was gonna be a little bit more cathartic than it was, but it mostly just made me angrier.
Yeah, that's also a part of our brand. Yeah,
we'll have you on in 3 more years to talk about whether like head coach Glenn Miller should be fired.
All right, I'm gonna hold you to that, Russ, and you'll probably be on in 6 years now.
Oh, boy. All right, Rob, well, thank you, man, appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, guys.